Today at Reader's Corner, Stephen Budiansky, author of Blackett's War, The Men Who Defeated the Nazi U-Boats and Brought Science to the Art of Warfare.
Blackett, his key point was scientists have to be involved in actual decisions about tactics and operations and strategy. Just imagine if an inventor had said, I have this new weapon which will allow you to kill 10 times as many U-boats as you have been. And here they were doing the same thing, but with an equation instead of a piece of hardware. The kind of role that Blackett's group played, civilian scientific experts being intimately involved in military tactics, operations, and even strategy, was institutionalized.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. During World War II, a small group of British and American scientists worked tirelessly to defeat the German U-boats that were wreaking havoc on Allied commerce. Armed with a dogged determination and a fair amount of mathematics, physics, and probability theory, they forged the new field of operational research and forever changed how wars were fought and won. At their head was Patrick Blackett, a former naval officer who would go on to win the 1948 Nobel Prize for Physics. Today's guest, Stephen Budiansky, chronicled Blackett's efforts in this new book titled Blackett's War, The Men Who Defeated the Nazi U-Boats and Brought Science to the Art of Warfare. In March 1941, German submarines, the infamous U-boats that were first utilized to such devastating effect in World War I, were sinking dozens of freighters in an effort to bring Britain to its knees. In an attempt to turn the tide, the British War Cabinet hired ardent socialist Blackett to wage and ultimately win a massive defensive push against tactics ranging from changing the color of bomber wings to reconfiguring the size of ocean convoys. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Stephen Budiansky. He is the author of 14 books about military history, espionage, science, and the natural world. A graduate of Yale and Harvard, his writing has appeared in many national publications. Mr. Budiansky joins us by phone for this interview. Stephen Budiansky, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
Well, we live in a world of big data, analytics. There isn't hardly anything we do in higher education these days where we're not relying on data to drive the decision-making, very sophisticated manipulation of data today. In fact, here in Boise, we have two or three firms that has analytics right in the name of the firm. It sounds to me like this is where it all started. Operational research, as the Brits coined the term. Is that correct? And how'd this happen?
Absolutely correct. And In fact, you know, the major professional society for analytics was the Operation Research Society. They've changed their name now to reflect the larger scope. But definitely, this is that intellectual discipline. It was the idea that basic scientific methods, basic understanding of statistics, wasn't just a tool for the physics laboratory, it could be applied to real-world problems.
And this was somewhat of a shift from the so-called old days prior to World War II, when a lot of these scientists were into gadgets, weapons and gadgets, creating things that they just handed off and then really never followed up on how you might get more efficient using them.
Yeah, and that wasn't so much the scientist's choice as the attitude of the military. Blackett really, I think his essential contribution, and he made this point again and again in lectures that he would give to the British Admiralty during World War II, his key point was, you, the military, have treated science as something sort of in this separate little sphere. Your view was, well, scientists come up with a new weapon or a new gadget and give it to us, the military men, and then we decide how to use it, and we say, thank you very much, your job is over. And Blackett said, well, the world is changing so fast, new technologies are changing so fast, you can't rely upon tradition, sort of the art of command, to figure out how best to employ these new technologies. He said, how you use these weapons most efficiently is every bit as much a scientific problem and question as developing these new technologies. So scientists have to be involved in actual decisions about tactics and operations and strategy. Well, as you can imagine, this was an idea which was radical, which met with a lot of resistance from traditional-minded military men. But World War II and the work that Blackett's group did in the war against the U-boats really changed that forever.
You also spend some time talking about Churchill's role in helping the British Navy understand how backward they were. I think you said something about the fact that Churchill actually had to force radar on the installation of the British Navy ships.
Churchill was certainly aware of radar, and he was one who early on, when he was First Lord of the Admiralty before he became Prime Minister in World War II, was on top of that. The earlier story, which was sort of amazing to me, was Henry Tizard, who was a British physicist who had been the head of this committee in the 1930s, which really shepherded the development of radar, which would prove, of course, so crucial to Britain in the Battle of Britain, defending against the Luftwaffe. And Tizard, early on, I mean, they were developing radar as an air defense weapon, but he thought, well, obviously this is going to be very valuable to the Navy to be able to see ships outside of visual range. And so he was speaking to a naval officer and explained this new wondrous weapon. And the officer rather stiffly said, "May I ask, have you ever seen a warship?" And Tizard said, "Yes, many times." He said, "Have you seen the radio masts?" And he said, "Yes." And the officer said, "Well, then you would know there isn't room for any new antenna on a warship." And he said, "Well, maybe you could take some of the other ones down." But, I mean, there was a lot of traditional mindsets. And Churchill played a very sort of contradictory role in his view of science. He was an enthusiast of science, almost this sort of Edwardian, you know, enthusiasm for the new gadgets and gizmos of the age, and he loved statistics too. So that was a good thing. He would get, though, these pet ideas, which he would run with and which would cause the scientists to be tearing their hair out dealing with that. But on balance, I think Blackett and the other war scientists were very pleased to have someone who recognized the importance of science in such an important political position.
Was the discovery of radar part of this operational research team's efforts?
Well, Blackett was on this Tizard committee, which developed radar in the mid-1930s. And the origins of operational research came right out of this experience, because the RAF was rapidly trying, with the war looming, rapidly trying to build up this large trained staff that could operate the air defense radars along the coast of Britain. And so they recruited really hundreds of physicists. They thought they were just going to come and sort of help install the equipment and show the RAF personnel how to, you know, twiddle the knobs. And again, what the scientists found was there were fundamental problems in operations, in how do you best get the information from the radar stations to the centers which would decide which squadron of fighter planes to scramble. What do you do when two radar sites are giving contradictory information about an incoming raid of bombers? How do you best figure out which is the one that's most likely to be correct? All of these turned out to be operational kinds of decisions and problems. And they actually founded the first group that was called an operational research group within this RAF radar effort. So it really grew out of that just before the war.
And, of course, the subtitle of your book, The Men Who Defeated the Nazi U-Boats, gets us to the point of Blackett's war centering on the U-boats. What was the goal of the campaign? First of all, how many of these U-boats were there out there on the seas at any one time, or how many did Germany manufacture?
And, you know, at the start of the war, they had a very small number. I mean, really a handful. At the peak, there was, over 100 at sea at any time. And they were really wreaking havoc at their peak of sinking large numbers of merchant vessels. Britain was completely dependent upon imports, not only for steel and oil and munitions to fight the war, but even for its very survival. Britain was a net importer of food. And so this was this vital ocean lifeline across the Atlantic. Germany's strategy was basically, we can't challenge the Royal Navy in a conventional fleet-to-fleet kind of big ocean Navy fight, but Britain does have this vulnerability of being so dependent on imports, and if we can sink enough merchant ships, we can bring Britain to her knees just by strangling the country. And so the goal really was this, it was a tonnage war. It was how many tons of shipping a month could the U-boats sink.
And there was a turning point where the German U-boats really did some serious damage. What was it, 7 British warships? What happened as a result of that?
Well, there was certainly a psychological blow when the U-boats, really in the first few months of the war, were able to sink a number of British warships. The more important thing, though, was this sort of slow motion, almost, as Churchill called it, this gripping, constant anxiety of the war against merchant shipping. And there were several turning points, and there were several things that were quite important in the Allies being able to fight back. There was the success of the Bletchley Park codebreakers in sometimes, though it was intermittent success, reading the German Enigma messages so they knew where the U-boats were deployed and they could route convoys safely around them. There was the development of the first airborne radar, which allowed patrol planes to spot surfaced U-boats at night. But also, really, I think, arguably even more important than either of those, was the work that Blackett's group did, first for RAF Coastal Command and then for the Admiralty itself, in analyzing how to more effectively bring the fight to the U-boats. And you mentioned in your introduction a number of the insights that Blackett's group had, which, such as the color of camouflage of the wings of patrol planes, the depth setting of depth charges. The striking thing about all of these discoveries that they made was that it involved no new technology, no new gizmos, no wonder weapons. It just involved using the tools that were already available more effectively. And the payoff was extraordinary. They would keep coming up with these almost sort of back-of-the-envelope kinds of calculations, which would result in a doubling or a tripling or sometimes a factor of 10 increase in the numbers of U-boats killed per hour of flying by a patrol plane, for example. Just imagine if a scientist, an inventor, had said, I have this new weapon which will allow you to kill 10 times as many U-boats as you have been. I mean, this would have been a miracle. And here they were doing the same thing, but with an equation instead of a new piece of hardware.
You're listening to Stephen Budiansky. He's the author of Blackett's War, The Men Who Defeated the Nazi U-Boats and Brought Science to the Art of Warfare. Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first picked up your book and read the title and read the subtitle, I opened it up looking for the gadgets, looking for inventions, looking for all this hard tech stuff that would be invented to do something. And then I read that, well, they figured out that they can change the color of the wings, and that'll have an effect. Boy, this was pretty rudimentary operations research at the beginning, wasn't it?
Well, yes and no. And, you know, Blackett was careful to say in some lectures he gave after the war, he said, I know this might sound like it was the scientists coming along and showing how stupid the military men were. He said that wasn't the situation at all. He said 9 times out of 10, we would analyze a problem and find the military was doing things the best way. But the 1 time out of 10, it would be simply that these questions either hadn't been asked or that they had been asked and had been answered by what seemed like a common sense approach, which actually turned out it was a very counterintuitive situation that required an outsider, I think, asking the right kind of questions with a scientific mindset to show that, no, if you did something different, it would produce a radically different result, radically better result. And I actually think there's something deceptively simple. It's the kind of thing, you know, it reminds me of how in the Sherlock Holmes story, Holmes is always complaining to Watson, you know, after you explain it, everyone says, oh, yes, that's obvious. It's so simple. He's saying, well, yeah, but it wasn't obvious until I asked the right question. And I think that was really the situation here to a large extent.
Well, and it sounds like the role of the consultant in organizational life today. And since we're talking about Blackett, why don't you tell us about Patrick Blackett, maybe one of the first organizational consultants. But if you could give us an idea.
Absolutely. And just, you know, as an aside, it was the work of particularly of Blackett's American counterparts like Phil Morse, who was an MIT physicist who worked on the anti-submarine problem. And after the war, he started one of the first operations research programs at MIT. And that this was management consultant. But Blackett really had an intriguing background. He had been a naval cadet when World War I broke out. He was rushed at age 17, into service. He saw combat. He was at the Battle of Jutland in World War I. Right after the war, the British Navy decided, well, we have this class of naval cadets who really hadn't had a chance to finish their education. Naval cadets, it was like high school age in Britain at that time. So we'll send them all to university for half a year to sort of round out their education. And Blackett was sent to Cambridge, and within a few weeks of arriving there, decided he was going to become a research scientist, and he resigned from the Navy. Within a few years, he had soared to the forefront of British physics. In the 1920s and early 30s, he would do the research that would win him the Nobel Prize in 1948. He discovered the positron, the first piece of antimatter ever discovered. Really an extraordinary experimentalist, but more than that, one of his colleagues said he'd never known the likes of Blackett in the ability to conceive a problem, to write out a few lines of mathematics, to design a piece of apparatus to carry out the experiment, to build the apparatus himself, to collect the data, and to analyze the result. And Blackett, another colleague said, he was one of these people who thought best with his hands, which I thought was a wonderful phrase. He had this amazing blend of theoretical and practical ability, which I think, in addition to his military experience, in some ways suited him perfectly for this role in advising the military in the anti-submarine campaign.
What kind of a team did Blackett assemble?
Well, it was this extraordinarily diverse group of scientists, and it was astronomers, biologists, geneticists, physiologists, expert on the sex life of the oyster, as he was described by their colleagues. I think, without any exaggeration, I tracked him down the name, and sure enough, there was this guy who published all of these papers on oyster breeding and reproduction. Blackett thought, actually, biologists tended to be better because they were more accustomed to dealing with messy data. Physicists wanted to be able to calculate things to 8 decimal points, and by the way, I should say, too, I mentioned how Blackett had this military background himself, but he was the only one of this whole group of probably like 50 scientists in all in Britain and America who did. Blackett said he thought actually people who didn't have any knowledge of the particular questions of U-boat warfare tended to do better because they came to it without any assumptions and were willing to sort of ask the dumb questions, which often turned out to be not so dumb. The thing they had in common, the scientific mindset, a good, very nuts and bolts understanding of statistics, and perhaps the sort of brash confidence of the outsider.
So these U-boats would be spotted and they'd be fired upon, but they would evade direct hits by diving quickly and deeply. What was it that Blackett's team did to get at that problem?
Discovered fairly quickly that air attack was the most effective attack against U-boats. An air patrol could, of course, comb a much larger area of the seas looking for a U-boat. And it's important to understand that at this time, with this technology, U-boats traveled on the surface most of the time. they had standing watch on the bridge of the U-boat, scanning all four quadrants of the sky with binoculars, constantly looking for airplanes. And if the second they would see a patrol plane, they would do a crash dive to try to get under the water before they would even be spotted. So the typical scenario would be a patrol plane would see a U-boat, the U-boat would see the patrol plane at pretty much the same time, dive. There would be a delay in time before the plane would get over the position where the U-boat was last seen, and then it could drop its depth charges and hope that one of them would hit the U-boat. What the Admiralty, the British Admiralty, had done was actually a pretty common sense sort of calculation. They said, well, it's typically 3/4 of a minute to a minute between the time the U-boat spotted and the time the patrol plane gets over in position to drop its depth charges. They knew how many feet per second a U-boat could dive, so they figured, okay, during that 3/4 of a minute or a minute, a U-boat will have managed to get down to about 150 feet. So they said, okay, we'll set the depth charges at 150 feet, and that'll give the best results on average. And what Blackett's scientists did was they started reanalyzing the attack data, and they saw the results were just abysmal. I mean, it was something like 1% of spotted U-boats were successfully attacked this way. And what they realized was, well, that's true. The depth charges were probably exploding at the right depth, but they were almost always in the wrong place, because a U-boat that's had 3/4 of a minute warning not only has a chance to get down deep, it has a chance to take evasive action left or right. So they said, only attack U-boats that are caught on the surface or within 15 seconds of diving, because then they wouldn't have had any time to take evasive action left or right. It means that this subset of targets will only be about 25 feet below the surface, so set the depth charges to 25 feet. And almost instantly, the number of successful kills tripled, and in time, it increased by a factor of 10. Astonishing change in the effectiveness. And it really turned air patrols from a pinprick annoyance to the U-boats to a devastating counterattack.
We're talking about Blackett's War, the men who defeated the Nazi U-boats and brought science to the art of warfare. Its author, Stephen Budiansky, is who we're talking to today. And it sure sounds like if you were a U-boat crew, You were in big trouble toward the end of that war once Blackett's team got to work on it. How many of those U-boats arrived?
Morale plummeted, and when the real climax of the war against the U-boats was the summer of 1943, when, again, after a long, really heated political debate that also got Admiral King, the U.S. Navy commander, in to the act. He was bitterly opposed to this plan that Blackett was pushing to concentrate the offensive within the Bay of Biscay. The U-boats had to transit the Bay of Biscay to get out into the Atlantic, and the scientists pointed out, well, this is a bottleneck, really, and we should concentrate the effort, really saturate air patrols in the Bay of Biscay. And when they did this, it was devastating, and morale just plummeted among the U-boat crews, and there was a sharp rise in the number of U-boats reporting apparently fictitious mechanical problems as soon as they set out and turning back to port. And really, you can see in a lot of the intelligence at the time, but in a lot of post-war accounts too, that this horror of the threat of air attack and the portrait of being at depth and undergoing a depth charge attack was just harrowing.
And why weren't these U-boats attacked by submarines? Why wasn't the strategy to go after them with our own subs or the British subs?
Well, you know, there were, I think, a very small number of submarines attacked by other submarines. Submarine warfare of that nature was in its infancy at that time. I mean, submarines were equipped with sonar, so there was the possibility of detecting another submerged vessel. But today, of course, that is a major role of attack submarines. In World War II, the understood role of submarines was to sink surface vessels. And again, none of these submarines in World War II were true submarines. They were really submersible ships. They had a limited duration underwater. They had to use electric batteries. And so it really wasn't until first the German invention of the snorkel, which occurred at the very end of World War II, and then, of course, nuclear propulsion, which allowed submarines to play this role of really having extended, stealthy underwater cruises where they could go and try to hunt the enemy.
So you say in your book, it is no exaggeration to say that few men did more to win the war against Nazi Germany than Patrick Blackett. Yeah. So did he come back to London and get a ticker tape parade, and did the Queen knight him? And I have a feeling I know the answer to this.
Yeah. Well, one of the curious and fascinating things about him was what a hard left, really doctrinaire Marxist he was. And there were several reasons for this, which we can understand, I think, even if we don't sympathize with him. For one thing, like many of the scientists of his generations, they were really struck during the Depression in the 20s and 30s, this huge gulf between the wonders of scientific discovery that were being made and the failure of these discoveries to improve the lot of the common man. And then, of course, they also were probably radicalized much more and much earlier than most people because they had these international contacts. They knew what was happening in Nazi Germany in the 30s with the Nazi oppression of the Jews and Jewish colleagues of theirs losing their jobs under the Nazi Aryan purity laws. But, you know, he was a real Marxist Blackett was, as were a number of his colleagues. That was, I think, truer of the British scientists than the American ones. Right after the war, Blackett became very critical of the United States and very sort of pro-Soviet. And there were already signs that he was troubled. Even the British Labour government, which came into power right after the war, didn't want anything to do with Blackett because he was too far to the left for them. So, no, he started butting heads right away and really went back and became a physicist. He really had no more of a role in military advice, though his legacy is undeniable. Today, operations research is a standard part of what every military cadet learns at West Point and the Naval Academy. You cannot find a three-star flag officer in the United States Navy today who does not have a civilian operations research scientist practically attached at the hip to him. I mean, it's standard now. And what a change from the environment that Blackett encountered. So, yeah, he did not personally get the accolades for his contributions to the war, though he won the Nobel Prize. He became president of the Royal Society, the preeminent British scientific organization. So it's not like he was a pariah.
Did the collaborative spirit or the camaraderie between scientists and the government that built up over the war years continue in peacetime?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's sort of what I was just alluding to, that I think it was night and day. It was, there were still differences in culture and still conflicts at times, but the kind of role that Blackett's group played of civilian scientific experts who were not military officers being intimately involved in decisions of military tactics, operations, and even strategy was institutionalized by what they did in World War II. And, you know, as I say, in the United States military, the British military, most militaries in the world now, it's absolutely standard operating procedure.
Well, this has been a great interview. I really appreciate your time and, most importantly, the book. Again, it's called Blackett's War, The Men Who Defeated the Nazi U-Boats and Brought Science to the Art of Warfare. Thank you so much for being with us, Steve.
My pleasure, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Stephen Budiansky. Next week, Bryce Andrews, author of Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.